Hello and welcome back to The Short Code, a podcast of wit and wisdom from the students at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. Temple Grandin was born in Boston and was diagnosed with high-functioning autism when she was 2 years old. She didn't talk until the age of four, and like many children who were different, found fitting into her neurotypical peer group difficult. In 1965, at the age of 18, she invented what she called a hug machine, or squeeze box, which she designed to alleviate stress through application of deep pressure stimulation. The pressure is similar to a hug, but not as overwhelming as hugs given by other people. The device, inspired by her observation that cattle being prepared for inoculation grow calm when they are confined in a so-called squeeze chute, and it's still in use today in several therapy programs around the country. Today, Temple Grandin is a doctor of animal science and professor at Colorado State University. She is a leader of both the animal welfare and autism advocacy movements. In the spring of 2012, she addressed an audience at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine.
I think I'll start out and hope the mic's working right. I just tell a little bit about myself. When I was 3 years old, I had no language. I was completely nonverbal. Then I went to a very good speech therapy school when I was 2.5 years old, where I got a lot of ABA type of speech therapy. And then when I was three, my mother hired a nanny who just constantly kept me occupied, taught me how to take turns. You got to teach these little kids how to take turns. And we all know you've got to get the 20 hours a week of one-on-one teaching. But a good teacher knows kind of how hard to push. You've got to kind of stretch these kids, because if you don't stretch them some, they don't advance. But you've got to be careful about sensory overload. You know, my teacher would kind of grab me by the chin and say, "Now, come on, pay attention." There's other kids, if you did that, they'll run and go in sensory overload and you're going to get nowhere with them. The child throws a fit every time he goes into Walmart. You've got very severe sensory problems. But the big thing is no surprises. When I was 15, I was afraid to go to my aunt's ranch. Mother says, "Well, you can go for a week or all summer." I had that choice. But not going, that was not going to be one of the options. You know, she was always pushing me slightly outside of my comfort zone. And I'm seeing too many of these kids where this isn't happening. Kids that don't learn table manners. Haven't been taught to shake hands. They don't know how to order food in restaurants. Just some of the most basic things. I talked to mom the other day, and she was afraid to have her child go in the 4-H rabbit program. I said, "Sign her up right now. You're going to have a rabbit in your backyard. And that's going to be the best thing she could ever do." It's almost getting overprotective. Now, sensory problems can occur along with many, many different disorders. And sensory is one area where I'd want to spend a lot of money on research, because it can be very debilitating. It's also very variable. One person can't stand fluorescent lights. Another person has sound sensitivity problems. Another person has touch sensitivity problems. I couldn't stand having scratchy things against my skin. And you know what? Some cotton itches and some cotton doesn't itch. I don't know why, but I discovered Old Navy khakis. Those are the only ones I'll wear now, because they don't itch. And it'd be pretty terrible if things just itch all the time. But sensory is very variable. It goes from being mild to being very debilitating. And to study this, we need to be doing studies where we look at the people with fluorescent light problems together, or the people with sound sensitivity problems together, and not be mixing up all the different types. Now, when I was little, loud sounds like the school bell, it hurt my ears like a dentist drill hitting a nerve. Now, the thing is, if the child initiates the sound, it's often better tolerated. My other thing I hated when I was a kid was balloons. I hated balloons because I never knew when they were going to pop. Now, one way to get over that would be to blow one up really tiny like this, and then I pop it. Then gradually make them bigger, but I pop them. You know, so, and then I might get to where I think popping balloons is really fun. See, this is one of the ways to desensitize. Some kids will wear headphones or earplugs, but you want to make sure they're off half the time. Because if you wear them all the time, the brain gets more sensitive. You've all had the experience where the doctor takes the earwax out and you go, "Oh boy, can I hear well?" Well, that's the brain compensating for the earwax. Now, when I was a little kid, I was two and a half years old in 1949, I went to Bronson Crothers at Boston Children's Hospital, And they were able to do two tests, hearing test, and they made sure I didn't have petit mal epilepsy, which I did not have. Now, my auditory threshold was normal, but I had problems hearing auditory detail. When the teachers talked really fast or my mother talked really fast, it sounded like gibberish. You got to slow down. You know, if you read books like Carly's Voice or Tito's How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move, they'll talk about information just coming in too fast. Can't screen out the information. Slow down. My speech teacher would stretch out and enunciate the hard consonant sounds. You know, some individuals describe hearing as like a bad mobile phone connection, kind of fading in and out. Well, that's going to cause problems with, learning to talk and things like that. There seem to be kind of two kinds of speech problems. One kind of speech problem is can't get it out. That's what I had, like a big stutter. Couldn't get the words out. Another kind of speech problem is echolalic. This kid's yakking all these TV commercials, and the speech output's working fine, but he doesn't know what they mean. Well, I'm going to be showing you some scans of my language output circuit, which is definitely not normal. And it's been kind of interesting going into a journey into the center of my mind. Another problem you have in autism and many other developmental disorders is attention-shifting slowness. It takes much longer to shift back and forth between two different things. You know, if you walk up to a kid and say, Tommy, hang up your coat, he might just hear the word coat, doesn't know what to do. Now you need to say, Tommy, I need to tell you to do something. Then you tell him to hang up the coat, because you got to get the channel open. This is some kind of old research that was done by Ami Klin. And when this research was originally done, they looked at it just from a social perspective. You know, okay, the normal person looks at the eyes. But I looked at this and I go, wait a minute, there's some other biology going on here. Look at how many times the normal person goes shifting back and forth the attention. Look at the attention shifting you've got here in the normal person compared to the autistic. And the autistic's looking at the mouth because they're not hearing very well, even though the auditory threshold is normal. Sometimes they just hear vowel sounds, and you've got another weird thing. Look at how that line is tracking the top of the couch. This was done with eye tracking software. When they were watching Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Boring social movie, kind of movie that sleep through that when they show it on a plane. Another problem that you can have in sensory-wise, and you can get it with dyslexia, ADHD, autism, also with head injuries. The thing that's interesting is these sensory problems are the same in head injuries. I think that might tell you something about the physiology. In a head injury, you rip circuits, and in a developmental disorder, circuits don't grow. But I had a dyslexic student. She was definitely not autistic, where when she'd go to look at things, the images would kind of break up. The print would jiggle on the page. Also talked to a kid who got hit right smack in the back of the head with a hockey puck, and he complained about the print jiggling on the page. And this can vary from very slight to very severe. And I have a class where my students have to design cattle handling facilities, and they have to make drawings. Students that have this problem absolutely cannot draw. If I ask them to draw a circle, they draw that. I ask them to draw a line and then another little line like that for a shoot, they can't draw that. Two lines kind of close together. And my dyslexic student said, I see the waves between the lines. Now, what's a sign that there's something wrong with the visual system? The eye exam may be normal, because the problem's back here in the part of the brain that we really don't know how it works. The circuits back there for shape, color, motion, and texture. Yes, you get head injuries, you get weird things like stop motion. How does a graphic image form? We don't know, but something's wrong with this. And you got kids that do a lot of eye flicking. And they'll look out the corner of their eye, because they can see better out the corner of their eye. And the kid's often terrified of escalators. Can't tell how to get on and off an escalator. But the big thing in architectural, or you know, buildings and stuff, is fluorescent lights. 60-cycle fluorescent lights. There's about 10% of the people labeled autism where they can see that flicker to where the room is flashing on and off like a strobe light. You know, I got asked about designing a school for autistic kids. No 60-cycle fluorescent lights. Now, I know that they're energy savers. I know all about that. Now, maybe the 400-cycle electronic ones will be all right, but not the 60-cycle. Or in Europe, it will be 50-cycle. They're horrible. And this can I mean, people have this problem. I mean, how could you study? How could you work in the middle of a strobe light? You ask them if when they go to read, do they ever see the print jiggle on the page? I'm finding 1 out of 60 students in my class has this problem. And I see these weird drawings where they can't draw. And I ask them, do you see the print jiggle on the page? Do fluorescent lights bother you? Do you hate escalators? Do you hate driving at night? People that have this problem usually hate to drive at night. And here's some simple things that you can do for this problem. Because we've got to have simple things in these days of funding cutbacks. If you got windows, get them over by the windows. If you can turn off the fluorescent lights, turn them off. If you're stuck with fluorescent lights, get an incandescent light. Not the twirly things that screw in. Those are terrible, too. The old-fashioned Edison-type light bulb, and put that in a lamp next to his desk. Maybe wear a hat. Tablets and laptops are the only computers that don't flicker. TV computers are awful. The older type screens, I'm not sure. You know, I think this one's going to be bad. It's fat enough to have a fluorescent light hidden in there. But if it's backlit with a fluorescent light, it's going to be bad. My dyslexic student would have flunked out of school without her laptop. And when I had her, laptops were really super expensive back then. Try printing the book on different pastel paper. One student might like lavender, tan, light blue. Try all the different pastel papers. I had one mom that had a little girl that was partially verbal that could only tolerate 5 minutes at the local Walmart. She bought some pink Disneyland glasses, and now she can do an hour of Walmart. I had another girl in my class come back with some pink glasses, and she says, oh, I got an A on my economics quiz because the PowerPoint slides weren't shaking anymore. Well, wouldn't it be stupid to flunk out of school if you didn't try colored glasses? How does this work? I don't know. You know, the Irwin lenses, you know, some people say, well, the theory is garbage. You see, I'm a bottom-up thinker, so I'd rather just say it has something to do with the stuff back here. We don't know how they work. We know where they're located. We don't know how they work at all. And you've got to pick out the colors that work for the particular person. The only advantage Irwin lenses could give you is you can pick out the exact color. But you can go down to the theater department and play with the gel papers. And you've got a good theater department. You can find something good there. Okay, the problem is severe sensory problems. And Carly, in Carly's voice, and Tito, in How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move, talk about the extreme effort required to screen out background noise and visual distractions. It's like the filtering mechanism. They can't keep all the information just piling into their brain. And then they'll stim. They do that to calm down. Now, the thing is, you let a kid stim all day, he's not going to develop. Some will need, Tito could type a little bit, and then he'd get up and flap, calm down, and then he could type a little more. Some people are mono-channel, can't see and hear at the same time. These extreme problems I don't have. My problems basically is a little bit of sound sensitivity. It's been damped down now with antidepressant medication. And touch sensitivity, don't like scratchy clothes, and things like that. That's my main problem. And when I got into puberty, I started having horrible anxiety attacks. Horrible, horrible. That's now controlled with antidepressant medication. Low-dose antidepressant medication. Best thing that ever happened. Cured the colitis attacks that I was having. That's why I'd eat yogurt and Jell-O all the time. The mistake that's made with antidepressants is giving too high a dose. I don't know how many parents have said to me, ooh, low dose was good, we doubled it, agitation and insomnia. Now, Eric Hollander just came out with a brand new paper in the Journal of Psychiatry with a huge, gigantic doses of Prozac in individuals with autism, and it was working. But then I went and checked his methods. Any sign of epilepsy, kick him out. Any sign of any cardiac problems, kick him out. That would have ruled me out because I got a heart murmur. It's very mild. You've got to be really good on the stethoscope to hear it, but it's there. So I would have been thrown out of that study. Yeah, 40 milligrams of Prozac, I can tell you right now, that's going to make most of them crazy. I know a lot of visual thinkers, people kind of like me, autistic and non-autistic, that, you know, like 10 or 20, that's plenty. Okay, here are great books if you really want to get... understand very severe sensory issues. You know, it's like the different systems in the brain are not working together. Both of these people are nonverbal and they type independently. Okay, scientists have learned a lot. sensory problems are real. It's about time it started studying sensory problems. We got 5,000 papers on brain scans on social. And for every paper on, every 100 papers on social, maybe we got one or two on sensory. And I wonder why. Well, I think the normal people relate to the social. They don't relate to an alternate sensory reality where things that don't bother most people bother people on the spectrum, also people with other disabilities, disorders. All the research is showing the back of the brain tends to be used more. Frontal cortex is used less. These are all things that have been shown. Because when you hear a word, you see a word, speak a word, or you think about a word, you know, there's got to be inter-office communications. That's where the abnormality is. That's what the NIH calls the connectome. All the circuits that connect everything else together. Well, that's a very abbreviated diagram of the connectome. That would be only the biggest interstates getting shown. And I kind of like to look at this like it's a highway route map of the United States. And on the East Coast, a bunch of freeways don't get built. There's the frontal cortex. There's a bunch of freeways that don't get built down to the amygdala, the emotion center. That's why there's problems with controlling emotion. So how did I learn to control emotion? I had to switch emotion. I had to get rid of aggression and switch aggression to crying. And I can get the giggles. Boy, when I start thinking about world's worst vomit flights I've been on or some kind of gross practical jokes that we did, I can get laughing so hard I can barely talk about it. Well, laughing and crying is much more socially acceptable than hauling off and hitting people. So when you have that lack of top-down control, you got to switch to switching emotions. On the West Coast, out there in Silicon Valley, we got extra circuits. You see, more stuff grows in the back. All these circuits grow back to front. So you get extra circuits in the back, and well, front East Coast, who cares about the East Coast anyway? Okay, now, this just shows that I've been doing some very interesting brain scan studies with Walter Schneider at the University of Pittsburgh. I hope these slides are going to work right. That's just a regular MRI. And what they can now image the inter-office communications. That's white matter, fiber bundles. And this scanner was funded by the Defense Department to look at torn circuits in veterans. DARPA paid for the scanner. This scanner goes where no other scanner ever gone before because you can track individual circuits, the origin, and then where it exits. Now, does a circuit cross each other like a freeway bridge, or does a circuit have an intersection? This scanner can tell the difference between an intersection and a crossover. So you can actually dissect out all the white matter fibers. Like if you take a formalin fixed brain and you can see the little white fibers, this scanner sees them. NIH also has a scanner, but it's not as good as this one. I mean, it's like this is the Hubble Space Telescope as to the Galileo's telescope. And you can see that a very, very big part of the brain is the connection stuff. You see, and you can see all those little tufts because it's scanning right out to where the gray matter joins the white matter. And that's just another picture there of my connectome. This is where we're really going to learn some things. And right now, just in the what we might call the playing around stage with this. Okay, let's just look at this. Let's, you know, it's like kids with a microscope, except we got a really cool microscope. And the Defense Department is not going to pay for autism research. This tool needs to be used to figure out what's going on with the circuits in autism research. You know, I wish Autism Speaks would put some money into that. In fact, we got a proposal out there right now. And now, right there is projection into the language center of the normal person. The white matter fibers for language output. In other words, say what I'm seeing. That's mine. Look at that big branched out thing. What's happening there is these circuits grow from back to front. And something stops it from growing forward, so it just bushes out off to the side. And I got circuits that went into my motor cortex. I mean, language circuits in the motor cortex probably didn't really help things very much. Now, you can see on this slide, let's just look at the amount of area that I have for speech production. You can see the normal one there's got a lot more area, a lot more little freeways going out there for speech output. I only had like way less. And that would explain why I had trouble getting my speech out. And I hope that this scanning technology can go to other places. It uses a 3 Tesla magnet. You have a 3 Tesla magnet. But then you got to have the magic computer box that DARPA paid for. There's different head pieces and receivers inside the scanner. I'm going to bet you somebody on the spectrum figured out how to put 25 or 30 supercomputers in an itty-bitty box, because when you look at the scanner, when you walk into the room and everything, it looks normal. You go in the control room and there's a computer box under the desk, and all that computing's in a box under the desk. It's not a room full of supercomputers. It's somebody with some Asperger genetics that figures out this sort of stuff. Because the thing is, autism's a very big spectrum. At one end, you got Steve Jobs, Einstein, and Silicon Valley. Einstein, no language till age 3. Other end of the spectrum, you've got a person that's a whole lot more severe. And the problem that we've got is educators that are good at working with a more severe end of the spectrum don't know what to do with the smart Aspies. You see, there's a point where you kind of diverge, and you need two different, very different kinds of services. And I'm seeing too many smart Aspies that are just kind of going nowhere because they're not learning job skills in middle school. When I was in middle school, I was doing a sewing job. When I was 14, I took care of 9 horses. I was painting signs and selling them. When I was in college, I worked in a research lab where I had to rent a house with another girl. I'm seeing smart Aspies graduating from college. They haven't even bagged a single grocery. This is something that really concerns me, because we're all the old Aspergers, or when they come out in the DMS-5, they're going to be social communication disorder. It's the same thing. And I can't wait until in the future be able to use a scanner like this where you go in and actually see how the circuits actually have grown. I mean, this is like, what I'm showing you here, this is like super advanced right here. I'm really honored that I got to be the first person other than a head injury person, because it was the Defense Department paid for this, for head injuries on veterans. And let me tell you, football players, it ain't pretty, because what you see is you see these things ripped like an earthquake hit it, like broken freeways in an earthquake. Okay, my auditory circuit, I got this little tiny auditory circuit. There's some really weird things. And there's also a weird visual shunts out where you get into the gray matter. There's like weird shunt circuits. We don't have any idea what's going on there. And the other thing they found, and he called this the pop-out finding, you have fibers that come out from the parietal, from the corpus callosum into the parietal area. So I got more association fibers than I got up in the front. Well, that's my search engine. Maybe that explains why I'm a bottom-up thinker. We start looking at the brain. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is biological determinism. There's still plasticity. Now, the plasticity might be out on the ends of these circuits. Maybe the freeway widens. You've got just a couple of big axons, but you widen them. Don't know. That's not known at this point. Now, it's evidence that things like visual thinking occur in normal people. Like you get Alzheimer's that wrecks the frontal cortex, wrecks the language areas of the brain. Well, art talent comes out. When Van Gogh painted Starry Night and he put all those twirly things in the sky, they were following mathematical patterns of water turbulence. The mathematicians went and let a computer work on those pictures. I can't emphasize enough developing the kid's strength. Kids on the spectrum have uneven skills. Good at one thing, bad at something else. I was good at art. And that showed up around 3rd and 4th grade. But all I wanted to do was do horse heads. Well, you got to broaden that fixation. Let's do the horse's stable. Let's do, we got to broaden things out. We got to think about what are they going to do when they grow up? If the kid likes horses, well, they can do study biology. How long does it take a horse to go from one place to another place? That's math. Now, I'm a total visual thinker, and this is a picture a young autistic man gave to me to show how he thinks in pictures like movies in his head. And the HBO movie did a fabulous job showing how I have pictures in my head. Mick Jackson, the director, he really got that. And thinking in pictures is really good when you're designing equipment. because you can visualize how things work. Half the cattle in this country are handling equipment I designed. I think that's pretty good for somebody that they thought was mentally retarded. And there's an aerial view of my dipping vat system that was built in the 70s that was recreated for the movie. All my building projects were accurate. We got to show kids interesting things. I got interested in that optical illusion room because I'd seen a movie about it. If we don't get kids, we shelter these kids too much. If we don't get them out and show them interesting things, they're not going to go anywhere. And where did I get socialization? Shared interests. Only place I was not teased was horseback riding, electronics lab, model rockets. We got to get kids into things like FFA, 4-H, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, the school play, band, journalism, art clubs, chess clubs, mathematics clubs. Get them out. That's where I get my social interaction. And there's my drawings. So how did I sell myself when you're an absolute total geek? I'd show off my drawings and they'd go, oh, you did that? I sold my work by showing off my portfolio. And you never know where you might meet somebody that would be interested. So now with today's phones, you better have your portfolio on your phone. It's artwork or it's math, programming, you know, whatever it is. There's another one of my drawings. Now, how do you form a concept when you have all these pictures floating around in your mind? This boy drew this little boxes in the head. You sort pictures into categories. It's bottom-up thinking. You take specific examples and you form concepts through compilations of specific examples. And that's how I think. And when I was first working on cattle handling facilities, I went to every feed yard in Arizona and I worked cattle. I went to feed yards down in Texas. And then I took all the good ideas and put them together and got rid of all the bad ideas. And I was one of the first people to notice that cattle were afraid of things like shadows. Most people didn't see that. People don't see stuff. You need the visual thinkers like me on a project because there were some design mistakes made on the Fukushima Japanese nuclear reactor I wouldn't make. I can't design a nuclear reactor, but maybe I better work on their safety systems. When you live by the sea, it's not too smart to put your emergency generators that run the emergency cooling pump in the basement. Because diesels don't run underwater. It's just that simple. And that's why 4 nuclear reactors burned up. Because diesel generators were not put in a waterproof room. Seems pretty elementary, but that was the reason. At Chernobyl, they turned off their safety systems to test them. Well, my safety system, they wouldn't be able to turn them off. Now, I realized my thinking was different when I asked people to think about a church steeple. How does it come into your mind? Now, I was shocked to find out that most people see this vague, generalized thing. No, I see specific ones. Okay, they flash up like Google pictures. Childhood ones, local ones, famous ones. It's everything. Everything is specific examples. Now, I could sort these into, you know, cathedrals, chapels, you know, but again, it's specific examples form a concept. I mean, somebody asked me one time, is capitalism a good system? Okay, so how do I use thinking in pictures to understand that? Well, I'm seeing examples from countries. Well, okay, U.S., Canada, you know, the capitalism, kind of socialistic, you know, Denmark, war and chaos. You know, it's, again, even to answer something that abstract, that's still done with specific examples. Now, this is some older type DTI imaging that showed I had a huge visual trunk line. This is a regular type of DTI. It cannot do the intersection problem, but it measures something. You know, as it gets this new, hopefully this new scanning technology become available. It's measuring, you can't just say all the DTI image is rubbish, but it's measuring something even though you can't tell what's an intersection and what's not. You're still measuring something against a control. And when I first got these scans back in 2006, I went like, wow, you know, big internet trunk line. And I do have some extra visual circuits that are showing up on the other scans, but the stuff's so far out, I don't, you know, not ready to put it out there yet. Take a slice up here. I got a real big circuit. You see that big bush up there in the frontal cortex? That's showing up on the other scan, and it's a lot of cross-linking circuits. You know, now is that out there on the end something to do with a lot of early intervention? Because that's maybe out where the plasticity might be. Just don't know. But bushes like that showed up on the other scans. You see, and then how do you compare this old type scanning where you don't know the intersections and the origins that accurately against the newer things? See, now it's like you're going from, you know, not so good telescope to the Hubble. Okay, that's a scan that was done out at the University of Utah, and I've got cerebral spinal fluid and a working memory. I got a math deficit. I mean, algebra absolutely makes no sense whatsoever to me. All right, here is an important slide. Skills tend to be uneven. I think in photorealistic pictures, and it can't do algebra. Another kind of mind is the pattern thinker, the music and math mind, poor in reading. These usually tend to show up around third or fourth grade. And there are actually scientific research to support these two differences that was done 10 years ago that I only managed to find after surfing the internet, and I clicked on a cited by, on a Google cited by. I was looking at a rather boring paper on visual perception, and it had a cited by, and it had some good stuff in the reference list, and there's a lady at Harvard that's doing work on this, and the idea that there's two kinds of visual thinking, photorealistic and more mathematical spatial. I kind of figured this out independently, and I just discovered her papers less than a year ago. They're kind of obscure. And then the verbal facts mind. This is the kid that loves history. And I'm finding on the employment scene, the verbal thinker's autistic type is the one that's having a hard time getting a job because they don't have fancy portfolios they can show off, like artwork, mathematics, programming. And when I did the book Different, Not Less, we got 14 old Aspies, you know, my age, that were diagnosed later in life because they had relationship problems. And to be in the book, they had to have been employed all their life. And I have all different kinds of people. I didn't fill it all up full of technical people. Yep, I got a computer guy, a doctor, a veterinarian, but I also have a tour guide, a clerk in a store, a psychiatric worker that just takes care of the patients in the hospital. You know, I had some of the lower level jobs too, because I'm really concerned about the job stuff. And I think we're having so much trouble with that because we're not teaching these work skills. And too many of these kids are coddled. I mean, I have kids come up to me at a book table and they got no idea how to shake hands. That has to be just demonstrated. And when kids make a social mistake, you don't scream no. Just give the instruction. Just calmly and quietly give the instruction. See, there's two ways to do math. You can do it the more verbal way, or you can do it the more pattern, visual, spatial way. Algebra is not the prerequisite for geometry. Geometry was invented first. Kid can't do algebra? Just jump them to geometry and trig. Now I want to give you a glimpse into the pattern thinker. This isn't my mind. That praying mantis is made out of a single sheet of folded paper. No cutting and no tape. And what you see in the background, that's the folding pattern. It's not my mind. I am really concerned that schools have been taking out the hands-on classes. Those are the things I just excelled in. I also think they teach practical problem-solving skills. I think one of the big problems we've got today, a lot of policymakers, they've never done anything practical. Well, they get a degree in government administration. Oh, yuck. or maybe poli-sci or something like that and go right from Washington, D.C. They've never worked on the nitty-gritty. They've never been in the trenches. You better believe it. Equipment startup at a meatpacking plant, been there, done that. You want in the trenches, that's in the trenches. So how do I think about something very abstract, like the power and the glory in the Lord's Prayer? Well, it's a rainbow. At the base of the rainbow, there's an electrical tower. That's the power and the glory. This is a really important slide. All my thinking uses specific examples to create concepts. It's bottom-up thinking, not top-down. And there's a ton of research. A lot of cognitive research shows that it's bottom-up, not top-down. All concepts are learned by specific example. This is why it's so important to get kids out and show them lots of stuff. You got to fill up the internet in their head. See, the thing about bottom-up thinking, to get their brains really good, you got to fill them up. Imagine it's an empty internet to start with. Really good search engine. My parietal bushes here. But you got to give something for those bushes to find. Because to understand something in the future, I got to compare it back to something in the past. Yeah, while we're talking about things in the past, that just for some reason want to say one other thing about medications. I'm just appalled at how Risperdal is being given to five-year-olds like candy, and coming up with a tardive dyskinesia, getting hugely disgustingly fat. They're using it as a sleep aid to stop fidgeting. There is a place for medication, and I'm not going to be going off through all that stuff today, but it's once you get out away from the medical centers, I'm sure you guys here don't do these awful things. But I talk to all the good doctors. I have psychiatrists that come to me all the time, and they say all they do is they're getting kids off of cocktails of all kinds of garbage. And there just hasn't been any thought. They get a crisis, they throw a drug at it, or they up the dose. They're not thinking about what they're doing. They'll give a prescription out to parents, three different things. Well, how do you even know which one does anything? You know, let's try to get more logical. You don't start a diet at the same time you start a drug. You get out away from the main medical centers, it's a wasteland out there. And when I first told Margaret Bowman about this, she didn't believe me. But then when she went out to California and she was in the wasteland, she says, yeah, now I understand what you were talking about. It's terrible. Okay, let's teach more bottom-up thinking things. Like you can take these things and I can categorize them. By shape, by color, by use, do they contain plastic? An object could be in more than one category, like maybe it's rectangular and yellow. You got to teach these sort of things. 20 questions is a great way to teach it. The autistic mind gets the details. Pick out the little letters faster than picking out the great big ones. Now, when I was young, people used to call me tape recorder and tease me. I had horrible teasing, and I couldn't figure out why they were calling me tape recorder. And some people say, well, is autistic learning, is memorization, is scripting? In the beginning, it is. Mine was that way. But then you got to fill up the internet. Got to get them out there doing stuff. Then I got more experiences where I can look at something new and compare it to something in the future. See, I read and I read and I read and I read. And one of the reasons why a lot of these kids like to read so much is they're trying to take in information. I didn't think my brain got good until I was in my 40s. Then I really started to understand a whole lot of stuff. Teach number concept. Count a variety of different things. You can have two computers, two people, two pennies, two bobby pins, two chairs. Applies to many different things. Teach adding and subtracting with different things. I got 5 pieces of candy, I eat 2, I got 3 left. Teach fractions by cutting up pizza, cutting up fruit. Cooking's great for teaching proportionality. But they've taken those kind of hands-on classes out in a lot of places. Teach word concepts with specific examples. You walk down the stairs. A plane goes down and lands. You put a cup down. You can start with the nouns, but then you got to teach words like in and over and on, between. But you got to use different specific examples. Now, I found that looking at things was a lot more interesting than looking at faces. But we need to have people in the world that are interested in things. Or we wouldn't have any electric lights. Tesla, who invented the power plant, probably was autistic. Now, what do you think would happen to little Albert Einstein in today's school system? How much Risperdal would he have been loaded up on? Who knows? Social interaction through shared interests. I can't emphasize that enough. These really teach important skills. Middle school is when we need to start working on teaching jobs. And I know I'm going to have a lot of time for questions. What about jobs for middle schoolers? If there's a paper route around, that's what they ought to be on. How about walking dogs? How about fixing computers for people? Make greeting cards and sell them. Making PowerPoint presentations for business people. Working in a farmer's market. They've got to learn how to do assignments that other people want. Middle school is when we need to be doing this. I'm seeing too many smart Aspies sitting around on Social Security playing video games. And to be in the Different Not Less book, they'd collected one drop of Social Security and they couldn't be in the book. There's two things they had to be. Employed all their life, supporting themselves. Now, some of them had to scrape by, some of them had problems. And the stories in that book are not easy roads. And they got diagnosed mainly because of relationship problems. Now, I go out to Silicon Valley, and then you got the happy Aspies out there that don't get diagnosed. And they're just there, sitting there in their cube programming, headphones on. And they're not social at all. And then you got the weird maintenance people that keep the meatpacking plants running, or the airplane mechanic with the world's dirtiest safety vest and all these pins all over them. Well, he keeps the planes flying. Need to have those kind of people. I think what I'll stop on my slides just right here, and we're going to, because I wanted enough time for some questions. So I'm going to pick somebody, unless somebody's got some questions. Okay, I'll repeat the questions. Okay, I can't believe it. I'm going to have to pick somebody. Oh, man, we got to break the ice here. Okay, right there.
How did I learn empathy? Yeah.
Well, you've got to just be taught sort of by specific example. When I was 3, and I don't even remember this, mother said I would pull the puppy's ear. She went, and then I never pulled the puppy's ear again because now I know how it felt. You know, it's not going to be in the abstract. And I've talked to several teachers where a kid was spit in their face, and they tried extinction, all the nice methods. I've had 3 different teachers tell me this is not nice, and in an exasperation, the teacher spat back, and the kid goes, "Ooh, you know what? It never happened again. Never happened again, because now they knew, but they had to experience the gunk on their face." Also, just examples. You know, the golden rule. Teach the golden rule one deed at a time. You do a good deed, somebody does a good deed back. You do something nice, somebody else will do something nice for you. Again, specific, real examples. They're not going to learn in the abstract. One of the things I'm finding is people ask these abstract questions like, what's the single most important thing parents can do for a kid with autism? Well, if he's 3 years old, it'd be 20 or 30 hours a week of intensive therapy. In some other situation, I can't say. I'd have to get more information. They tend to ask these overly generalized questions. Well, because the normal human brain overgeneralizes, drops out the detail. Nancy Minshew actually has a brain scan study, and that was done with just regular functional MRI to show that the normal mind drops out detail. And I'm finding I get these vague questions. They write them in on the internet. I can't even begin to answer them. I don't have enough information. Behavior issue in the classroom? What's that? I don't even know how old the kid is. I don't know I don't know anything about him. Okay.
You've described a way of learning that's a little hard for us to sort of take in and appreciate. But I'm kind of wondering, as you sample all these specifics and you build concepts, do you think you end up at the same place? That is, can you now take those and have generalized concepts? Like, can you see a general steeple as a person?
Okay, this is a good question. The question was, I'm having all these specific examples, and you were saying you have a hard time kind of understanding that. So what you basically were asking is, do I take all these specific examples and can I make a generalized concept? I can fabricate one. Okay, now that steeple that I had there on that slide, I spent half an hour on the internet finding sort of what I thought a generalized one would look like based on what people have told me. It actually is an advertisement for fiberglass steeples. what's a generalized, if I said factory, a generalized factory? Well, you know, people think, you know, especially if you're my age, you think something like that, smokestacks. I can fabricate it, but there still isn't really any generalized one. I think cathedrals, I get one bunch of pictures. If you say the French word for dog, chien, I get a different set of pictures. And if you say the U.S., get a different set of pictures. I can think, on the church steeples, chapels. Then you've got some churches where it's like a metal steel shed and, you know, it's just really plain. They can go in the metal steel shed category. Everything is specific examples, but I can switch those all around, and it works like a search engine works. I found that when the search engines first came out, I go, wow, I love search engines. They work exactly like how my mind works. Who do you think made search engines? Yeah, you see that? See, a lot of people think they got to have a hypothesis first before you do an experiment. It's sort of, I do my research the other way around. Well, let's kind of play around and then we've been thinking about like what the projects do with the scanner. That's easy. Play around with it and then, let's mess around with a few people and then you figure out the project. And that oftentimes works really well. There's places where bottom-up thinking works really well. The problem with bottom-up thinking is to make it work well, you have to have an awful lot of data put in the database. Got to have a lot of web pages stuffed in here to search. So when I notice in science, people don't go across disciplines. I read across disciplines. Most people just say, okay, doctors read the medical journals, veterinarians read the veterinary journals, neuroscience read their stuff. I read all the stuff. I get on Google Scholar and pulling down papers from everywhere. And I was going deaf 5 years ago, I solved that. And what the key was? The good papers were all in the Journal of Rheumatology. Why are ear papers in the Journal of Rheumatology? Autoimmune. Pure and simple. And the most important thing I got was the title of the journal. And I have extremely good, literature reviewing skills. Sift through tons of stuff and No, there's a place where we need to have bottom-up thinkers. And what's happening now with top-down thinking and things like policymaking is that it's getting too top-down because you're getting people in making policy now. They haven't ever built anything. They don't cook. They don't do any of the hands-on things. And, sometimes hands-on things don't work. I had somebody ask me one time, this just blew my mind, could you ever make beef slaughter plant perfect? No. Nothing in the practical world is perfect. I can make it very, very good, but I can't make it perfect. Can every doctor in here do surgery perfectly every time? No. You can get it up very, very good, but never perfect. I'm finding there's some people that don't understand that, and that just blows my mind. Okay, in the back.
I've read some recent research about speculation that autism or Asperger's really an autoimmune.
Okay, the question was, is autism autoimmune rather than a specific disorder? Autoimmune stuff seems to go along with it. But looking at the genetics, and I've been just going through a bunch of genetics literature, there's all these different genes. You've got SHANK genes involved with the brain development, FOX genes involved with language, another genes involved with epilepsy, another one with heart problems. And it's little tiny code variations in brain development genes. Some of them are de novo mutations, which means they're just spontaneously mutated. I think there's other things where environmental contaminants may affect it. Some of it's inherited stuff. I think the autoimmune co-occurs with it rather than causes it. Because I've got autoimmune problems. My hearing thing, we had to whack that back with prednisone, and then the doctors didn't know how to wean me off, and I figured it out, accidental discovery. Mother let me have a prescription for a rash, betamethasone, and I found when I put it on the rash, it helped my ear. I looked it up on the internet, and I go, oh, wow, that's an atom bomb of steroids. Got to be careful with that stuff. And then I read baseball players put it on here. Then I went out to dinner with a horse vet, and I said, how long does the horse's adrenal recover? Every 3 weeks. So I rubbed it on here. Every 3 weeks, 3 times, it weaned me off. It worked. It worked. I was losing my hearing. And I've talked to other people that went to the Mayo Clinic and they didn't wean them off right and they lost their hearing. 2 weeks on the computer on the Mean Science Project. Yep, I used my bottom-up thinking. And the thing is, the solution was simple. A week on Pred, 80 milligrams a day. It was like, awful. Awful. All I did was clean my house during that. And then I went off the Pred, and then I went. I'd start to feel my ear getting pressure again. Put a little bit on here. 3 weeks later, because I had to give the adrenal time to recover. This is like so far off label; it's like disgusting. So the doctor that gave me the prescription just said, "Put it on the rash," but it worked. And it was extremely simple. Because one thing I learned in design is think simple. And you never know where you're going to find a solution to a problem. And I had all these papers on cochlear implants. I mean, I was just freaking. Because this one got to where it wouldn't hear on the phone. And I had a 25% chance of losing this one, according to literature. I mean, I was just freaking out about losing my hearing. And so I had papers on cochlear implants. I mean, I was just looking at everything. And the solution was very simple. Okay, right over here, right there. Okay, the question is animals helping children with autism or individuals with autism. They can be really helpful for some individuals. And I find there's kind of three different ways that people on the spectrum relate to animals. The first one is a magical relationship, the best buds with the dog. They really understand each other. It's the best thing you could ever do. The second kind is they're kind of scared of them in the beginning, but then they warm up and like them. Then there's a third kind where the animals are not appropriate. The cat meows, it hurts their ears. They don't like the smell of the dog. It's just simply not going to work. They may hit the dog if he barks because it hurts their ears. And the problem with an animal is you never know when it might meow or bark. See, this is where autism is real variable. Horseback riding, I've had some parents say their kid did the first words on a horse. Rhythm and balancing. The OTs, those two things together. I've got a little paper I did with Lorna King years ago in an OT journal on speech sounds coming out of a nonverbal kid on the swing. Right there.
You say to get your child that's on the spectrum involved in camps and activities. When you're a parent entering your child, high-functioning child on the spectrum, into a camp with 10 other mainstream kids and your child is on the spectrum, it's intimidating. And do you recommend having a meeting before with the teacher?
Yes, definitely.
In the middle, because at any time, your child could be going along fine in the class. Two things can happen. Your child can go off and read and be forgotten about.
Yeah.
You need that teacher.
The teacher's got to pull them in. They can't just let them go off and read. You've got to pull them into things.
And they also have to know how to deal with the situation if your child has a panic attack, yep, or sound or whatever. But sometimes it's pretty intimidating to think about putting your child in a club.
Well, I think it's a question concerned me, scared about putting them into something. Well, you need to sit down with the teachers, and if they has a panic attack, let them, go off somewhere. And for older kids and adults, too many panic attacks is a point we need a little dab of Prozac. Visual thinkers like me, every visual designer I know is taking either Prozac, Zoloft, or Lexapro. These are the non-autistic ones.
Would you recommend having that relationship, even if it's a week?
Yes.
If it's a week camp,
yes.
Before and say, this is what...
And the other thing, you meet with them. The other thing is, I'd show the kid all the pictures I could find at the camp. So I want to get rid of the surprise factor, because surprises cause panic. And you'd explain, if he has a tantrum, you just let him calm down and avoid the kind of situations that might cause that. And because mother had a really good sense of what I could do and what I couldn't do. She knew that big noisy places were really bad. Well, if the kids have problems with a lot of noise, well, then I wouldn't pick a camp with a lot of noisy activities. But I've talked to a number of parents where the child was afraid to go to sleepaway camp, but then when he went, he loved it. Once I got out to the ranch, I loved it. I didn't want to go originally. If I hadn't gone to the ranch when I was 15, I wouldn't have gone into the cattle industry. I kind of, where I think I would have been if I hadn't gone? Handyman at an apartment complex. That's probably what I ended up doing. Maybe working in a maintenance shop at a meatpacking plant. Well, that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gone out west. But I've seen people that, you've got to, there's always going to be some risk. I think sometimes we're overprotecting these kids. No, I definitely want a meeting beforehand, explain the situation. The other thing to get the camp interested, show off some of the good things a kid does, like his artwork or whatever. Let's show that to the people. Hi, right there.
What if you try to take these very specific pictures and try to average them out?
How do I average the pictures out? How do I average the pictures out? Well, I don't. I basically, let's go back to church steeples. I mean, I can have, okay, local in Fort Collins. That's a set. That's a category. I could have childhood ones. That'd be another category. Then I might have famous cathedrals. Could be another category. Then I've got country chapels with the white steeple. Then I've got the metal building churches. Now, they all go in a big file folder of churches. Okay, you see how? See, that's just like how a computer program's set up, branching. I know it's hard for some people to get their head around this, but if you don't understand this, you're going to have a hard time teaching kids with autism. Average them out. Think about it. What is the average-sized dog? What is the average between a Great Dane and a Dachshund? No, seriously. Dachshund's a little small. How about the average between a miniature poodle and a Great Dane? Yeah, but that's not the average, taking a gray wolf. That's the ancestor of the dogs. That's not the average of a Great Dane and a poodle. I can put them into categories like small, medium, and large. Dogs can be put in different categories like sporting, hunting, retrieving, shepherds, guard dogs, the lap dogs. I can put them in categories. But I still see specific pictures. I mean, I see Pomeranians, pugs, Chihuahuas. That's in the the toy dog category. Rottweilers and German Shepherds in the guard dog category. Border Collies in the herding category. I actually see pretty much specific examples. Rottweiler, I see the one next door that used to bark under my window. Okay, one more quick one right there.
One more quick question.
I'm wondering about social things. You started off by saying that it was difficult for you. You obviously have a great sense of humor and you've learned how to manage large audiences. Have you fabricated the ability to have meaningful and
well, the question concerns how did I learn how to, be a good public speaker? I was a terrible public speaker originally. First talk I ever gave in graduate school, I panicked and walked out because I froze. I learned have really good slides. Because what the slides do is they cue you. And so when I did my first cattle talks, I had fabulous slides. And I make sure my students, when they go into their animal science meetings, have fabulous slides because they freeze. I go, if you freeze on 10-minute scientific talks, read your slides, it's not the end of the world. And you get better with practice because the drawing ability, but even that has to be developed. That's why my employment book is called Developing Talents. You've got to work on it. I didn't learn cattle handling stuff overnight. I spent 3 years just learning it. It didn't happen immediately. You've got to develop things. And then it's just algebra. So it's hopeless. There's no way I'm going to be an algebra specialist. But as you learn, you get better. And people tell me that my talks at age 60 are better than my talks at age 50. So even at an older age, you keep learning as you fill up the database with more information. Okay, well, I want to thank everybody for coming. And
thanks for listening to The Short Coat. The Short Coat is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, you can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we're known as The Short Coat. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com. Or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. That's also where you can submit a question for our advice segment, The Short Couch. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our theme music is by Revolution Void from the album Increase the Dosage. Find them at www.revolutionvoid.com.